coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. If you plan to rent at the Delaware beaches this year, prepare to pay a little more thanks to a new state tax on short-term rentals.
It adds $45 to every $1,000 charged for a rental property. And it really adds up, especially if you are renting an expensive property.
Contributor Eileen Dalabrida looks at this new tax on the beach rental market this year. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine efforts to improve the health and well-being of Black girls in Delaware. Arts Playlist previews a Wilmington group's new concert seeking to provide a musical refuge. And Enlighten Me explores the challenges of sticking to New Year's resolutions. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week's warmer temperatures may offer some hope that winter is on its way out, perhaps enough hope to start dreaming of summer vacation. If that dream includes getting away to the beach later this year, you may need to budget a little more. A new Delaware tax on short-term rentals means the price for fun in the sun in the first state is a bit higher this year. Contributor Eileen Dalabrida takes a closer look at the beach rental market and the impact of this new state tax in her latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And she joined me this week to offer her insight into how things look this year. So, Eileen, tell us, what is this new state short-term rental tax? What does it cover, and when did it go into effect?
Well, it is a 4.5% tax. It went into effect on January 1st, and it impacts short-term rentals, which are defined as single-family homes, townhomes, apartments, condominiums, houseboats, even cabins and trailers that are rented to guests for 31 consecutive nights or less.
So largely, it's almost anything that you would rent if you want to go spend a week at the beach.
That's correct.
So what does this tax do in terms of the price of rentals? Can you give us some examples that might give people a sense of, when you add this on, what does it actually mean?
Well, it adds $45 to every $1,000 charged for a rental property. And it really adds up, especially if you are renting an expensive property, right? Because the more rent you pay, the more short-term rental tax you pay on that. So here's an example. There's a five-bedroom, five-bath house with a pool in Indian Beach, which is a very nice private community in Dewey. And so there's a two-week minimum rental, $24,250, and the tax adds almost $1,100 to the rental fee.
So basically, the prime rentals are the ones that are going to really feel the effect of this tax the most.
Yes.
And this is just one of several costs that wind up getting tacked on to a rental, correct? So when you see a list price, you got to be careful to factor not just this tax in, but all the other things that get added on when you rent a place at the beach.
The fees are significant, and a lot of them are hidden or unexpected. For example, a three-bedroom, two-bath condo at the Henlopen, which is an oceanfront place in Rehoboth, and it rents for just under $4,000 a week for the second week in July. But after a $115 processing fee, another $115 for a damage waiver, a $206 charge for linens, sheets and towels, and $279 in local Rehoboth tax and $174 in Delaware state tax, the new tax, the tally comes to $4,800. It's about $900 above the list price.
And that is obviously something that people have to take into account when they're thinking about how much do I want to spend and also still have the kind of money I want to go out to dinner with and do things throughout the week. It does become pretty expensive pretty quick. Has there been a sense of what the reaction has been to this tax? I mean, are people even aware of it at this point?
I don't think it's on a lot of vacationers' radar, but it sure is with the real estate pros. And I spoke with a woman whose agent mailed her contract for this summer in December, just so she could avoid paying the 4.5% tax.
At least for 1 year, escape the tax. But obviously, I guess
for one year only.
For the real estate agents, I guess they have to, I guess when they're talking to people about these properties, I guess they've got to try to warn them of like this tax, but also just like, hey, you know, what we were talking about earlier, just you got to factor in all this other stuff as well, which I guess makes their job a little bit harder when it comes to selling, rental properties.
Yep. There you go.
So Sussex County also considered its own short-term rental tax late last year, and they decided against it. And I guess this kind of goes to what we were just talking about. Is there some concern that eventually, you know, all these taxes and fees are going to hurt the market and maybe drive people away from renting at the Delaware beaches? Or is the price to rent in Delaware still reasonably competitive regionally when you look, say, at like Ocean City, Maryland, or places over at the Jersey Shore?
Well, for many years, Delaware was one of only three states, the others are Alaska and California, that didn't charge a state short-term rental tax. So that if things like that were on your radar, that was a competitive advantage. And I think that's part of the reason why Sussex County decided not to add another 3% on with its own short-term rental tax. 7.5% in a year is something that, that's significant. And I think that they thought that might hurt Delaware competitively.
Although I guess there is the argument that these type of taxes, like on rentals, can be kind of popular ones for politicians because they, to a certain point, affect maybe more people who don't live in Sussex County or don't live in Delaware. If you're presuming a lot of people are coming in from out of state to vacation, hey, we're going to get some revenue from people who don't live here so we don't have to raise property taxes instead. I mean, it can be a popular way to a point.
Yes. Vacationers aren't sending their kids to school or paying for roads and improvements and things like that. So it is something that does help, especially local taxes from smaller communities mm-hmm. that don't have huge sources of revenue.
And it's the good news is that a lot of the people who are paying this tax don't vote, so they won't vote you out of office if they're not happy with the tax. Tax or no tax, though, Eileen, people are going to head to the beach. I mean, that's for sure. Let's talk a little bit more just generally what the market looks like this year. And are there still good options available if you want to go to the beach and pay the extra on this tax?
Yes, there are. But a lot of the prime weeks are already taken. People now are buttoning up their rental property if they rent a place and they like it the day they leave. So a lot of great places have been taken since August. But there are still good options available. But I think that if you do want to rent a place at the beach, you need to get right on it.
I was going to say, tax or no tax, I mean, just the kind of base prices, are they pretty much similar to what we've seen in recent years?
They have gone up a little bit, but not a lot. And there are pretty hefty premiums for hot ticket items, especially properties that have swimming pools.
Mm-hmm. If you can't afford some of these pricier spots that have maybe the premium price tags on them, are there some other options that are beach adjacent? Or is it a potential for shorter term rentals if you just want maybe a quick getaway as opposed to a full week or 2 weeks?
Well, the rule of thumb is the further you are from the beach, the less you pay. Selbyville is more affordable than Rehoboth or Bethany. If you did but just want a short getaway, I would look for like fill-in times at hotels that are have just these very little short blocks and are eager to fill those rooms.
I guess that's one way you can get down there and be like, hey, if you're not there on the weekends, which maybe are the premium times, you might be able to get a slightly cheaper rental for a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday at a hotel and still have the opportunity to be at the beach for a little while.
Yeah, that's right.
But I guess the other thing about that, though, and particularly when you talk about maybe being a little less adjacent to the beach, going to somewhere like Selbyville is, then you got to factor in the logistics of getting where you want to go. And I guess that's the trade-off, right? You pay less, but you may have to deal with more headaches if you want to enjoy your time there.
Yeah, and there are prices to that. I mean, to make that drive to the beach and find parking and pay for it. And, you know, you can't go home for lunch and you're buying lunch wherever you're staying or on the beach.
Right.
So it there are definite hassle factors in logistics of taking that less expensive rental that is a significant distance from the one and only Atlantic Ocean.
So for those people who might be listening to this and say, you know what, instead of renting and spending all this money, maybe I'll just buy a place at the beach. And that way I don't have to worry about all of this. If you've got the means to do that, is the market good to buy a beach place and then maybe rent it out to other people instead?
Well, the housing in Sussex County has gotten expensive. I mean, it's more expensive than houses in Newcastle County and has been for more than a year. The median home price in Sussex is $465,000 compared to $350,000 in Newcastle. And that also includes housing that is in the western part of the county. Still, I've talked to real estate professionals that say that some beach buyers are indeed splitting the difference, living in a home part of the year and renting it out during the vacation season. Recently, a couple bought a condo and their game plan going in was to rent the property 12 weeks a year in hopes that that would cover most of their expenses for buying the house.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dellabrita for her time on The Green this week. Her piece on summer beach rentals and a new short-term rental tax in Delaware is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We take a look at the challenges faced by Black girls in Delaware and what's being done to promote their health and well-being. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Many studies show the persistent disparities Black Americans face when it comes to health and well-being. But one portion of that population is less understood, including here in the First State. This week, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee examines what we know and don't know about Black girls' well-being in Delaware and what can be done to produce positive change for them.
If you're looking for answers about how Black girls are faring day to day, you're going to have to put in some work.
Is there data? Yes, about Black girls in various segments. Yes, but not all in one location. And again, bits and pieces and along with everyone else, not something that was dedicated specifically to the lives of Black girls.
That's Charisse Brewington Carr, past president of the National Coalition of 100 Black Women's Delaware Chapter. She's also one of the co-leaders of the State of Our Union, Black Girls in Delaware, a first-of-its-kind study published in 2021 examining the daily lives and well-being of Black girls ages 10 to 19, covering topics like self-image, experiences of racism, support systems, and safety. The study's lead researcher, Katrina Morrison, a policy scientist at the University of Delaware, says the study wasn't meant to cover everything.
The Black girl population might sound like a monolith, but they are not.
The report found Black girls in Delaware face persistent disparities in mental health, education, and safety, and struggled to build resilience, aspirations, and support networks. But 4 years later, many of those challenges remain, and Morrison says meaningful progress to address them has been limited.
As far as a visible kind of policy that would hold folks across the state accountable to ensuring the health and well-being of Black girls, I don't see that, and I'd like to. So if that was my bar of how to measure if there's enough, I would say no.
Wilmington City Council member and founder of the Black maternal health advocacy group Black Mothers in Power, Shanae Darby, agrees.
There hasn't been any policy, or after this report was published, there hasn't been like a great movement to like address some of these things specifically for Black girls.
Where the state has acted recently, the focus has largely been on Black women. For example, House Bill 313 passed last year makes sure all women in prison are checked for breast cancer every year or 2 years. Delaware has also taken steps to address Black maternal health, including expanding Medicaid coverage for doulas and implementing policies to improve maternal care, an effort aimed at combating racial disparities in maternal mortality. But these efforts don't necessarily speak to the needs of Black girls. To do that, there's a consensus that more data is needed. While the State of Our Union Black Girls in Delaware study provides some information to build on, Darby believes more concerted efforts are needed to develop additional meaningful data on Black girls and the issues they face.
If you look at a lot of research and studies, Black girls are least likely to be heard, seen, talked about, looked for.
Morrison concurs, noting the lack of data on both Black women and girls has been recognized but overlooked for decades.
It's how we fill that gap and recognizing that, you know, Black girls, their identities rest at this place of like interlocking oppressions, and that needs particular attention.
But co-chair and co-founder of the Haitian Coalition of Delaware, Kata Dariska, warns against waiting for data to seek solutions.
It's sort of like a moot point in a way. And I hate to say it because not having data should not invalidate someone's experience. Having data is vitally important for us to find solutions. It's neither chicken or egg. It's just both eggs. We just need both. Because without the data, we don't have the numbers to show these are the amount of people being affected. This is why we need funding.
One area where there is some data to help start a conversation is the need for spaces where Black girls feel safe and connected. Schools don't seem to provide that. The U.S. Government Accountability Office reports that Black girls receive more frequent and harsher discipline in schools than other girls. The same goes for Black girls in Delaware, according to the State of Our Union report. Dariska says Black girls need the space and grace to just be themselves.
If Black girls and students are provided a safe space to be who they are, and it is nurtured positively, and they are given resources, or even the opportunity to ask for resources, it changes the trajectory of their lives. And it also impacts their self-esteem, their mental health, their emotional health.
UD's Morrison agrees creating spaces for Black girls is essential.
That's what I'd like to see, like more programs that help Black girls feel safe and belong, more spaces that help Black girls feel safe and belong and connect with one another, and possibly even some local bills that make sure certain things are put in place to help them feel safe and feel welcome.
Brewington Carr argues having safe spaces can help eliminate negative and unrealistic expectations of Black girls.
I think every Black woman or Black girl would want is just free to be who they are in and of themselves with, again, telling authentically from our own stories versus, you know, someone else assuming what the role should be.
Darby notes a key part of creating these safe spaces for Black girls is asking them where they spend their time.
We can't say we're creating a program and then expect Black girls to come running. And we got to go to them. We got to go to those TikToks. We got to go to the schools. We got to go to where they are in the community center. We got to figure out where they're shopping at.
But creating pockets of safety through community initiatives and organizations is only a start. A comprehensive sense of safety needs to be backed up with legislative action on the local, state, or federal level.
As it relates to Black girls, around the adage of diversity, equity, and inclusion, everything that we learned in this data indicated to us that things are not equitable.
And efforts to develop that equity now face another potential obstacle. Since coming back into office, the Trump administration has made a series of moves targeting programs and practices promoting equity. Most notably, a January 20th executive order labels DEI programs as, quote, discriminatory and illegal, mandating that all federal government entities terminate DEI initiatives, offices, and positions, along with equity-related grants or contracts. A federal judge recently blocked that order, but DEI-related programs on all levels face uncertainty as that legal battle plays out. The Trump administration's effort to freeze federal payments for grants and assistance could also hinder work by local nonprofits on these issues, leaving the Haitian Coalition of Delaware's Dariska concerned about the future.
It worries me that marginalized communities will not receive the support that they need. It worries me that people will go into the shadows and in a space where some people are already losing, we're already losing, and we were working towards reclaiming or highlighting or building resources for communities, that is essentially being all torn down.
Wilmington Councilwoman Darby says that means redoubling support for community organizations across the first state that focus on Black girls.
I have always seen girl programs that exist for girls to be a part of, to talk about self-confidence and love. And so, like, internally in our community, we have always created things that supported Black girls.
And these groups are not hard to find. Several are stepping up to support Black girls, including the National Coalition of 100 Black Women and Black Greek organizations within the state. Dariska says the best way forward is to turn to these and other local support systems that already exist.
In a space where the things happening at the federal level are out of our control, some of our control, right? Leaning into your community is vitally important. Leaning into trusted individuals within your community, leaning into your friends, leaning into your family, leaning into community organizations or people in your community that you can really have genuine conversations with, build with, and be able to vent with, but then also be able to organize with, is important.
Abigail Lee, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Abigail. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we head to Wilmington to preview the Center City Chorale's upcoming concert promoting connection and community. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Many of us are seeking support and a sense of community in what can seem like turbulent times. On March 6th, the Center City Chorale offers a musical refuge with Spirit Songs, a free concert at Wilmington's First and Central Presbyterian Church, with a diverse lineup of music it says will calm your soul and feed your spirit. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny is joined by local musician Jordan Barrett, board president of Market Street Music, which Center City Chorale is part of, to preview Spirit Songs and how music can provide comfort and connection amid uncertainty.
Let me start by just asking you to tell me a little bit about Center City Chorale and its history.
Sure. Center City Chorale traces its history back decades to the 1970s, and it is an adult community choir, all volunteer, no audition. And one of the things that makes it remarkable is that oftentimes this type of choir requires some sort of tuition or payment from its participants, but it is totally free of charge for its participants, totally supported by Market Street Music. It's made of people who mostly currently or formerly worked downtown. The concept is that they can do this on their lunch break. They rehearse for an hour on Tuesday afternoons. But there are others who have just learned about the choir and travel in as well. But despite the fact that they're all amateur singers, they sing at a higher level than you might expect from a typical amateur choir, because they work very hard and they take it very seriously. And our artistic director, David Chalot, is very skilled at working with singers and people. So he makes it fun, rehearsals are fun, and it's a great community. And so they produce something really remarkable.
And roughly how many members are there in the chorale?
Generally, it's about 35 or so. It varies depending on who's available to participate, but about 35.
This concert's theme coming up on March 6th is Spirit Songs. And I wonder how that concept came about. How did that idea get started?
Well, oftentimes themes for concerts come from a particular piece that you're interested in, and then you build a theme around it. And that's what happened here. For this concert, that piece was The Spirit of the Lord by Philip Stopford, which is sort of a substantial piece that David thought would be challenging but achievable for the choir. Oftentimes when we hear the word spirit, we think the Christian Holy Spirit, but this piece takes its text from the Hebrew scriptures before the concept of Holy Spirit came about. And then we added three pieces that are about the Christian Holy Spirit, from two from traditional Western composers, but then one from Nigeria that includes different sounds, instruments. And then finally, a totally secular piece, setting of a poem by Robert Frost called Choose Something Like a Star, where you might imagine that the star is a sort of spirit. So essentially the theme of this concert is the idea that people of all faiths or no faith at all often turn to some sort of spirit for guidance or comfort.
And you mentioned performing some music from non-Western composers. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about the piece from Nigeria that you mentioned.
Yes, yes. It's called Wa 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 E Mi Mi Mo. It's a traditional Nigerian melody, but it's arranged by artistic director David Chalot, and it just has one simple text that translates to Come, O Holy Spirit, Come. And it's written for two parts, and they essentially just kind of go back and forth and echo each other with some rhythmic instruments in between.
What can, and I know you touched a little bit on the repertoire, but in a larger sense, what can audiences expect to hear and see at this concert?
Well, I think that they can expect to be inspired by really committed and earnest music making. It happens in a beautiful room that is perfect sonically for choirs. The text is going to be in the program, so they can expect to really be able to follow it along and understand what the text is. Our overwhelming feeling at Market Street Music is that good music changes people. And so I think people can expect to be inspired and changed, and hopefully inspired to come back to some of our other concerts, because these free concerts happen weekly in the spring and fall, and they're a broad, broad variety. So we hope people will be inspired by the concert and inspired to come back.
Talking a little bit more about the idea of spirit songs. We live in kind of anxious times right now. There's a lot of anxiety, a lot of weirdness out there. A lot of people are dispirited. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about sort of the power of music to shed a better light on things, to kind of help us still find some inspiration.
Well, I think that texts like these demonstrate the fact that people have always looked to something external for some help or some guidance. Throughout history, from antiquity all the way to today. And I think that people in confusing times, they're not sure where to turn. And so they look up to the sky, to God, to whatever their faith leader is, for some sort of guidance and comfort. And I think that in a moment like this, you can come in for 30 minutes, just be transported somewhere else. I think that even if you're not of a particular faith and you don't, the guidance from a particular spirit doesn't quite resonate with you, just the fact that music can just transport you to a different place, even if for half an hour. I know it as a professional musician myself. It's just, there's nothing like it to replace it. So I think that that is really the power of something like this.
And you mentioned concerts going on during the spring and fall. Can you talk about some upcoming performances in the next couple of months as well?
Yes, so this concert on March 6th kicks off our Thursday Noontime Concert series. We have two concerts, main concert series that we do in the Thursday Noontime Concerts. They're short, half an hour bits at 12:30 on Thursdays. They are totally free of charge. We have a donation basket if you're so inspired to donate, but there's no barrier to entry. And they include an incredibly broad variety of styles. So, for example, the week after this concert will be the Shiraz Ensemble, which is a group of people from Iran, and they will create a soundscape unlike anything you've heard that will totally transport you away from 11th and Market Street. Next week, come back and hear jazz. And then the week after that, you can come hear an accordion player. So it's just, there's something for everyone, and anyone can come and be inspired by these. And then if you come and say, well, I think I'd like a little more of this, we actually have our festival concert series, which are full-length concerts. And the first one of those happens on Saturday, March 15th, and that is a group called Variant 6 with the Sylvan Concert of Viols. It's six singers and six viol players, which is an early kind of ancestor to the violin. And an instrument that's thought often to mimic the human voice. And so you come and hear how voices and those viols kind of come together with both early music and a world premiere of a new piece.
Wonderful. Speaking about the afternoon concert series, the Thursday afternoon series, one thing that strikes me is that a lot of times there are barriers to entry to experiencing art music, classical music. And this feels like a little bit more laid back, informal, not as intimidating experience, right?
It is for many reasons. One, it's in a community landmark that people know, First and Central Presbyterian Church. We are welcoming to everyone who comes. The wide variety of music, it feels kind of less perhaps stuffy, I hate to use that term, than a typical classical music concert. It's short, digestible pieces. And then on top of that, I should mention that for people who the barrier to entry is simply coming to the building, we actually recently started a series called Music Where We Are, where we bring several times per season one of these acts from our Thursday Noontime concerts to a place where the people there might not get the chance to come, like a senior center or a school or an apartment building, that kind of thing.
And then finally, just to reiterate, where to go and when to hear Spirit Songs.
Spirit Songs is happening March 6th, Thursday, at First and Central Presbyterian Church at 12:30 p.m. Really hope to see you there.
Thanks to local musician Jordan Barrett, board president of Market Street Music, and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we close out the green next with Enlighten Me, where we explore the challenges of sticking to New Year's resolutions and ways to effectively turn goals into lasting habits. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. As we move into March, that early year momentum and motivation to stick with New Year's resolutions often starts to fade. Roughly 80% of resolutions don't make it past mid-February. So why is it so hard to turn goals into lasting habits? Some experts say it has to do with how our brains are wired to favor immediate rewards over long-term benefits, making change a challenge. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon speaks with University of Delaware Associate Professor of Psychological and Brain Sciences, Naomi Sade, about why resolutions are tough to stick with and what can help us keep them.
From a psychological perspective, why do so many New Year's resolutions fall apart so quickly?
That's a great question. I mean, the simplest way to put it is life gets in the way, I think. So people have really good intentions at the beginning of the year. Then things like viruses, illnesses, stress at work, you know, maybe the weather has you snowed in that day and you break your habit. Things get in the way that interrupt these intentions and make it difficult for us to stick with them in the long run. Doesn't mean they can't, you know, work out and people can't develop these habits, but it is common and I think expected that people will struggle and have bumps along the way.
Right. And I'm guessing some types of goals or resolutions are more likely to succeed than others. So what about that? And how much of this depends on what the actual resolution is and how difficult it may be? As in, you know, we essentially overwhelm ourselves and make a hill too steep to climb instead of setting a goal that's, you know, more doable or realistic.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So oftentimes goals that are much too big, given where we're at when we're starting the goal, are the ones that are going to be most difficult for us to follow through on. So I think it does make a lot of sense for people who are either trying to get back into their New Year's resolutions, because it's never too late, right? We can always start again. We don't have to start, you know, wait until January. But we have to be really realistic about what we can work into our lives. So it may not be going to the gym every morning if that's not something you're already doing, but maybe you can link something that you are already doing to 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes of exercise in the morning or in the evening. One key to really being successful in the long term is to not only be realistic, but also make it rewarding in some way. You know, if it was easy, we would already be doing it, right? And although it's rewarding in the long run, when we're feeling better and we're sleeping better because we're healthier, there is a hurdle to get over there. It's tough at first, right? If it wasn't, we would already be doing it. So a lot of times people will recommend, you know, what can you do to make it simple and make it integrated into your life easily, but also make it rewarding. So after so many days of getting up and, you know, doing those exercises right when you get out of bed in the morning, do you gain some sort of privilege or reward? Or maybe you only get to watch your favorite TV show when you're on the treadmill or at the gym on the elliptical. Those sorts of pairings between the new behavior and rewarding systems in the brain are going to make it more likely that those two experiences become linked in the future, and you're more likely to continue to do those behaviors. And over time, you won't need the reward anymore, because it will be, you know, naturally reinforcing, naturally rewarding that you're building mastery and kind of gaining these goals that you set out to accomplish.
You know, what exactly makes a resolution here more like achievable? I'm sure a lot of it depends on the actual person and like you said, just kind of approaching it from a pragmatic standpoint. But what makes a resolution more achievable for us?
I think the more, I guess, you kind of have to know who you are too, to make it as achievable as possible. So for some people, it'll be, for instance, social support. You know, if you have that friend or that partner, or, you know, that coworker who is going to meet you at the gym every morning and help motivate you to stay on schedule, and you help motivate them as well, that link there, the social support, might be what that, you know, one person needs to really succeed in that situation, just because it's so motivating for them, or they don't want to let somebody down or be ashamed that they're not following through. For another person, it might be, you know, the health benefits of it. Let's say you start out really sore or you can't do much at the gym, but then over time you do notice that you're more flexible and you're able to run longer. That for that person, if they were, let's say, dealing with pain throughout the day because they, you know, hadn't been exercising, just the decrease in pain over time from engaging in those exercises might be what that person needs. So it really does kind of differ for every person. I think that a common thing that gets in the way of achieving and maintaining goals for everyone is stress, right? So negative emotions, whether it's physical stress or fatigue from not sleeping, it's from going on social media or, you know, reading political outlets that stress you out, or just the stress of everyday life, right? Going to work, childcare, school, all those things. We know that people are more likely to break habits and be impulsive when they are stressed in those ways. And so that is one reason why you have to make the goal realistic, because if you're just adding stress on top of yourself by making it so big or so large that you're likely going to, you know, feel disappointed when, for instance, something comes up at work and you can't make it to the gym that day, it is much more likely that you're going to kind of break that habit. And people, unfortunately, tend to have this way of approaching goals sometimes where if you, you know, skip one time or you miss one week, that you're just less, you're more likely to give up altogether and not kind of go back to it. So instead, expecting those things and saying, hey, if I have a slip up, I'm not going to totally give up here. I'm going to go back out. I'm going to expect at least one or two slip ups a week, and be proud of myself if that doesn't happen. But, you know, making sure that you're not only kind to yourself and forgive yourself when you don't make those goals, but also not giving up because of it, I think is an important thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, getting away from that all or nothing mindset. And I can certainly see how the current state of our world and such, those stressors and anxieties can certainly deter you. But I mentioned this to you off air before we started, but as a longtime gym goer myself, as far as this goes, it might be the most visual or physical representation of what we're talking about today. I'm sure our listeners out there, who maybe also regularly go to the gym, know what I'm getting at, to where in January you'll see two or three times the amount of people that normally go. And then around literally this time, like clockwork, that number drops off a cliff. So Naomi, all of this, no matter what your resolution or goal is, though, all of this that we're talking about today essentially revolves around habit forming. I've read that it takes anywhere from, 20 days to some odd months to form a new habit. Malcolm Gladwell, the Canadian author and journalist, has spoken about how it takes 10,000 hours to become a master or an expert in anything. That might not apply here, but can you give us some insight into why forming habits is so hard and how long it realistically can take?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of different systems coming together to make behavior change. So behavior change is really hard. As psychologists, it's what we focus on in therapy, right? Whether it's giving up drinking that's making you be difficult to complete your job or live in the world, or whether it's, forming new ways of coping so that you're not hurting yourself, for instance. It's really hard to do. I think that, what gets in the way, and I know I said this already, but is life. I mean, I was, just to go out on a tangent here, when I got the flu, I was out for 10 days, right? So whatever habits I was trying to form in the weeks before that, if it's not already a habit at that point, I feel like I have to start all over after 10 days. And that can be really hard to do without the excitement of the New Year resolution, right? That's why people get on board. They're like, I had a great holiday. Maybe I gained some weight or drank too much or ate too much. I'm ready to make a change. And as you go through life and you keep having setbacks, when it comes to reaching your goals, you can become, disheartened, a little bit hopeless about it, especially if you don't have a support system. So whether it's, that friend that's helping you out, or maybe the whole family's making a change, or a provider, going to physical therapy, you have accountability there, right? It's a paid person, but it's a person that's helping keep you on track, even after major setbacks. Unfortunately, most of us don't have that anymore. We might have some online social media groups that we belong to that are about getting in shape or quitting a new habit. But it seems like more and more it is difficult to connect with other people around goals. And that is a big motivator, especially when you're having a hard time or you've fallen off track. So for, people who are interested in getting back on the horse at this point or starting again, running groups, any sort of group where you're meeting up with other folks who have a similar goal can really be helpful for, keeping everyone on track, feeling supported, getting you through the days where you just don't feel like doing it. I think that more with our busy schedules, it's hard to have those sorts of connections and commitments to each other. And I do think that they're helpful when they're there.
Yeah, and this isn't supposed to be easy, right? You mentioned that earlier where, if it was easy and, doable and, just kind of hand a glove, you'd be doing it already. So I think that's part of it too, right? Where understandably a lot of people, just underestimate how hard it is to form a new habit, right?
Yes, it is a commitment, right? You need a plan. You need a plan of how frequently you're going to be doing things. You need a plan of how you're going to reward yourself at first, because it's going to be hard. They talk about visualizing how it might go wrong and then coming up with strategies. So if I'm on a diet, maybe I'm going to meal prep for this week. if one week I can't meal prep, what am I going to do in that situation so that I don't fall all the way back, you know, to zero in terms of breaking the habit? So anticipating how it might go wrong and coming up with contingency plans is another helpful approach. And making it fun if you can. I think the people who succeed the most in these sorts of behavior change scenarios are the ones where ultimately they enjoy it. You know, maybe not at first, but over time it becomes more and more rewarding. And always when we do things that we set out to do successfully, we have a sense of pride, and it does help us maintain those behaviors over time. But you're absolutely right. It's really hard. It's really hard to, you know, we call it delaying rewards, where you're going to do something really hard right now so that in the future you might have a benefit that pays off, whether it's weight loss or fitness or cutting down on social media use, whatever your goal is. But it is hard for people to kind of keep that in their mind, what might be a reward down, you know, in the future when they have something more immediate that comes up that might be an obstacle or more rewarding right now, like, you know, sitting on the couch instead of going out to the gym, for instance.
Yeah, right. You touched on this earlier, but a notion that I think applies here is that in some senses, the real discipline here is being undisciplined, meaning that, you know, as much as we should commit to our given resolution, we should remember to, you know, go easy on ourselves and be realistic in the fact that this won't be perfect. It's not supposed to be a perfect process. You know, sometimes just trying is enough, especially when you've had a setback or you feel like quitting. What do you make of that? And, you know, this idea of just being more, you know, kinder to ourselves, more gentle on ourselves in this context.
Yeah, my brain goes back to what we know about things that cause us to break habits and be impulsive, right? Do the thing that's easier that we're used to doing versus a new behavior. And negative emotions and stress is, you know, one of the biggest things that's going to make someone act that way. So if you're hard on yourself, you're creating potentially shame, guilt, all these negative emotions in yourself. And really all that's going to do is make it harder for you to stick to your plan.
Thanks to UD Associate Professor of Psychological and Brain Sciences, Naomi Sade, and our Kyle McKinnon for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor Eileen Dallabrita, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee, Martin Matheny, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.